This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And hey there, all of you political convention wonks. This is a day for listening closely, because if you listened closely last night to the convention speech of Melania Trump, you would have heard first an impassioned endorsement of her husband to be commander-in-chief from someone who knows him better than anyone else in Cleveland this week.
I have seen him fight for years to get the project done or even start it, and he does not give up.
And then you close listeners would have heard this.
From a young age, my parents impressed on me the values that you work hard for what you want in life.
Perhaps that reminded you of a speech Michelle Obama gave back in 2008.
And Barack and I were raised with so many of the same values. Like, you work hard for what you want in life.
What? Michelle Obama gave a speech about Donald Trump back in 08? Of course not. Seems that parts of the Melania speech last night were lifted from the Michelle Obama speech endorsing her husband 8 years ago. The Trump campaign leadership was asked about the apparent plagiarism. Quote, this is a statement. In writing her beautiful speech, Melania's team of writers took notes on her life's inspirations and in some instances included fragments that reflected her own thinking. Melania's immigrant experience and love for America shone through in her speech, which made it such a success. Success was not a view shared by our listener, Linda, from the very blue state of Massachusetts.
It feels like a parody. It feels like a pitiful showing of these celebrity wannabes at this convention. And I don't feel that there's any substance or quality or Trump's wife was the last straw. And it's only going to get worse.
Here are a few other reactions from people around the country who paid attention to the convention proceedings last night.
You know, the first half of the convention kind of reminded me of the part of a gangster movie where somebody is smothered by a pillow. Some gangster is smothered by a pillow. And after that, everybody's agreeable and on the same side. Well, you know, once you get past the rules fight, there's really not a lot that's going to be able to be fought about in this convention.
I was thinking maybe that this whole phenomenon of Trumpism is like almost a return of the old right, and now it's like the new right fighting the old right.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, heard reaction from around the country on a special call-in show last night. He also watched the proceedings from floor level. So as you spent the evening at the convention, what was the growing sense of this theme of American security, safety in America, that everyone seemed to hit over and over again?
Well, John, I spent a lot of time yesterday with one particular delegate who I met during the primaries. Her name is Lee Snover. She's from Easton, Pennsylvania. She owns a construction business there, longtime Republican, active in local Republican politics. This is her third convention, but her first one as a delegate. And I spent a lot of time with Lee before and after all of the divisiveness and disunity that happened on the convention floor yesterday over the rules, over Donald Trump as a nominee, and whether or not hundreds, if not up to 1,000 delegates, can actually back Donald Trump. Here's what Lee Snover, who is a dedicated Trump delegate, had to say about those folks.
But you know what I think? I think the last night of this convention, when the curtain closes, the lights go out, and it locks up, they better be on board. If they're not on board, I think Donald Trump is going to run against them the same as he is a Democrat establishment. I think he's going to lump them as all establishment, and he's going to turn the whole thing around. I think he's going to say, these guys that aren't on board, they're establishment, and he's going to run against them. It's almost like Noah's Ark. If they don't get on and it closes, they're in trouble.
What does she make of the delegate challenges that seem to simmer on the floor there in the beginning?
Well, you know, Lee Snover, of course, doesn't support them. But here's one thing that's really interesting. She and all of her Pennsylvania colleagues have been targets because Lee Snover from Pennsylvania is an unbound delegate by rule. She's dedicated to Donald Trump. She's not gettable. But, John, she told me that she's gotten dozens of texts and calls, even handwritten letters in the mail in the weeks in the run-up to the convention, asking her to be flexible, asking her to abandon Donald Trump.
Snover is a construction contractor. She runs a construction business in Easton, Pennsylvania, right?
Yeah, she does. And John, this is one of the things that Lee seems to like best about Donald Trump, their shared experience in the construction business. She says that it helps her really get him and really get what his worldview is all about. He knows how to build things, and so does she. And one of the things we talked about was how Trump can win. when he's doing so poorly with Latino voters all across the country, lately polling with about 14% positive ratings from Latino voters. And Lee says that she sees a far different intention behind Donald Trump's words when he says he's going to deport 12 million illegal immigrants. She says it's code. She doesn't really buy it.
People that know Donald Trump know, people that work in the industry that he's been involved in for years, he uses Latino labor on all of his sites. We know, you know, it's almost in code he's talking. We know exactly what he's saying. If you're not producing, you're going. If you're producing, you're staying. And we all believe that.
Well, John, if Lee gets it so well and she gets the code, I'm not sure that everybody who works for her necessarily does. And she told me a story of what happened on her job site recently when she broke out a pro-Trump sign and sort of inadvertently drove across a job site with it. Everybody saw the sign and they reacted.
It's very mixed on the job site. I don't know if it was in fear or concern that Trump might win. I think they were thinking, wow, even right here on this job site, there's Trump supporters. They know we're working. Why do they support Trump? Do they not want us here anymore? I think that's what they were thinking.
You think they're intimidated?
No, I don't think they're intimidated. I think they're thinking, how could she be working in this industry and support Donald Trump knowing that he may deport us? But I don't believe he will. I believe if they're working and producing and living right and not criminals, they're not going anywhere.
Well, party unity or even the appearance of it was hard to come by on the first day of the convention, as you just heard. Even the opportunity for a unifying moment from Melania Trump was marred by accusations of plagiarism in her speech. So another attempt today, as Republicans talk about the theme Making America Work Again, family members of Donald Trump, including Tiffany Trump and Donald Trump Jr., are scheduled to speak, as well as a number of leading Republican figures. Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, who at the last minute was still a potential VP pick for Donald Trump, is scheduled to speak, but so are several members of Congress. House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy was for Donald Trump almost immediately. He's speaking tonight, but so is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who, when he came out on the stage for ceremonial purposes on the first day, was booed by several members of the crowd here. House Speaker Paul Ryan is also speaking, and Paul Ryan has walked a very, very delicate line with Donald Trump, endorsing his candidacy, but 5 or even 6 times taking to microphones to rebuke and criticize Donald Trump for various controversial things that he has said. And Paul Ryan, for his own part, needs to try to defend the Republican majority in the House no matter what happens at the top of the ticket.
Let's take you on a little tour of the convention yesterday with Todd as he journeyed from the floor to the stage and back and got a real sense of that disunity that needs to become unity by the end of the week.
This convention will come to order.
Well, you just heard it. The procedural intonations from RNC Chairman Reince Priebus there, gaveling in the Republican National Convention. When the day started, it did look like any other made-for-TV political gathering. Right outside the Quicken Loans Arena in Cleveland, the Texas delegation in their traditional cowboy hats and Lone Star shirts, the Montana delegates in their denim vests. People are buying fattening food and drinking and getting ready to enjoy 4 days of parties and mixers and also speeches.
The best governors, the best leaders are those who get out of the government bubble and see what's really happening.
Inside, Cleveland looks like any other convention. Crowded concourses, the bad food again, long lines, and a convention floor immaculately constructed for rendering in high-def TV. So the Republican convention in Cleveland starts off just like every other convention, until it's not.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman! Point of order!
For months, different forces inside the GOP have been trying to derail Donald Trump's coronation this week. They've maneuvered in rules committees, they've tried to convince delegates to flip, they've even gone to court. None of it's worked. There were rumors that another move was afoot to get enough delegate signatures to force the convention to hold a roll call vote on adopting the rules. The point here, to have a vote, a real vote, and not just a rubber stamp gavel from the podium. And they were only rumors till I ran into former New Hampshire Senator Gordon Humphrey, who was roaming the floor with a list in his hands and not making any secret that he'd like a little press attention.
This is the highest plenary body of the Republican Party. It is not an adjunct of the RNC. It is superior to the RNC. They work for us, not vice versa. And neither is it a meeting of the Supreme Soviet. Delegates are the highest governing authority. They have the authority to make any rules they wish. They could require us to wear prison stripes if they chose to do so. And it's beginning to feel around here like that might not be a bad idea, because delegates are very much in danger of being shorn of their rights.
It was on. Humphrey took a few of us with him as he hunted for the secretary of the convention so he could formally submit those signatures he was carrying around. But she wasn't at her desk. In fact, she wasn't anywhere to be found.
Well, this is very interesting. We are required by Rule 39 to present these petitions to the secretary. The secretary is in the back room somewhere, not available to do business under Rule 39, and we have a time limit. So you can see that conventions sometimes are not well run, and just possibly sometimes there are dirty tricks that are played. I'm not sure which this is.
Eventually, a qualified representative of the secretary was found. The signatures were submitted, and while speech after speech on the dais talked about Republican values and Republican unity, the delegates wait. What will the captains of the convention do?
I'm on the Trump Finance Committee. It's not about Donald Trump. The problem with it is he might have been in on it a little bit, and if he was, you know, that's the way it goes. It's politics. You know, it's a blood sport, contact sport, right? But in the end, to not let people discuss this and to squash any debate to make it look like there's unity, all they did is made a power keg out of it. That's all. See, that's what they always do. They want to. It's a pep rally. At the end of the day, they've weakened the power of the delegates, and they've centralized more power in Republican Party headquarters with the chairman.
Finally, the rules package comes up on the floor. Humphrey and hundreds of other delegates, they say up to 1,000, wait for their moment.
The chair has found insufficient support for the request for a record vote.
Some delegates don't want Donald Trump. Some want the GOP to simply give more voice to what's supposed to be a voting process. Some want new rules for how the primaries are run in 2020. It doesn't matter. The vote never happened. And now the question for people like anti-Trump Republican Utah Senator Mike Lee is next moves. Will delegates who got shut out continue to try to disrupt the made-for-TV Donald Trump convention?
They've been calling for unity. They've been saying, we need unity, we need unity. It's great, but it's not really unity when you don't have unity. In the absence of unity, a call for unity is a call for something rather unlike unity. In fact, it's coercion masquerading as unity.
The truth about these Republican and Democratic political infomercials is they tend to be the same year after year. So far, this one isn't.
Adventures from Cleveland all this week from Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. The killing of three police officers in Baton Rouge, Louisiana over the weekend is the second high-profile shooting of police officers by a military veteran in recent weeks. The Dallas gunman also served in the military, and the horrible Fort Hood shooting back in 2009 was carried out by a U.S. Army major. Is military service some path of domestic radicalization? What do veterans think about the impression of radical, angry veterans with guns, raising questions about all veterans? And when veterans are polled about access to guns, 90% say they would support some form of gun control. Retired General David Petraeus, along with other retired veterans, such as General Stanley McChrystal and Admiral Eric Olson, are part of the Veterans Coalition for Common Sense to put their support behind responsible ownership. Chris Marvin is a retired U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter pilot, now a principal at Marvin Strategies. It's a consulting firm that takes a look at veteran-related strategies. Marvin believes the Baton Rouge and Dallas shootings do raise some alarming issues.
We've been dealing for a number of years with misperceptions of veterans. And I think this brings about what I would hesitate to call the Rambo effect. This idea that people see veterans as sort of one of three things. Either veterans are these wonderful heroes, they're these poor victims, or they're these terrible monsters. And in this case, unfortunately, it sounds like the third. But when you look more closely at these individuals, they certainly don't represent the veteran population at large. And they don't even have a military history that would reinforce some of the inappropriate stereotypes we carry, such as PTSD, that a lot of folks in our society like to label many veterans with. as soon as you sort of turn the page and learn a little bit about these folks, you realize that their veteran status probably doesn't have a lot to do with the terrible crimes they committed.
Do you think the Veterans Administration or the government bears any responsibility to follow individuals, whether for simply assuring that their mental health is in good shape, following them in terms of being able to help them as they move on with their lives, and that these individuals, you know, were kind of on their own with an internal narrative that led them to this very, very brutal, you know, crime?
To say that any government administration should be looking after 22 million Americans, which is how many veterans we have, I think is a little bit overstepping, that they could keep tabs on every single one. You know, that said, I think the conversation about these two guys being veterans actually becomes a little bit of a distraction. I think in all these cases where we have a mass shooting, whether it's perpetrated against police officers or against any group, school children or people at a holiday party, I think you have a lot of society asking questions. And they're looking for something to attach blame to say, well, there's something about that person that's either different from me or different from what I consider normal, and that must be why they did it. But you can't lump all of these folks together with all veterans. You can't say that all veterans are the same thing.
No. And I think no one would try to do that. I think right. The question really is, as we search for what is the mode of radicalization of individuals who then commit violence anywhere in the world, there are places that we have to look. And I think we don't really understand what turns someone into an individual who wants to commit violence. But idea that there is some potential trigger within the military, along with many other places in society, is an appropriate question to ask, yes?
Well, I think that the military is a profession of arms. And therefore, you know, you have the skill set to utilize firearms. But I would say that the veteran, the person who had actually been trained to use the firearm, is also trained with the discipline and discretion necessary to not use the firearm. And so I really believe that these two individuals are, they're anomalies, they're exception to the rules. And in this case, the problem isn't that there's veterans who are sort of, you know, going down the wrong path. It's the problem that the veterans or anybody, non-veterans who go down the wrong path, have access to firearms.
Although people who are for the Second Amendment would say that, how are you going to control access to firearms for individuals like that? How is that any easier or more appropriate than trying to keep tabs on 22 million veterans? You know what I mean? It's just, you got to control access for everyone if you're going to control access for anyone.
I think that's exactly right. You have to control access for everyone. And I actually think it was Dallas Police Chief David Brown who might have said it best when it comes to this situation. He talked about the fact that he's asking lawmakers to do their jobs and to pass laws that both sides agree will help control access to guns for everyone and anyone who might be a danger to, you know, any portion of society. And that these lawmakers need to quit asking the police officers to be the ones who chime in and sort of do that for them. That this idea that the gun lobby is pushing a guns everywhere for everyone with no questions asked is just a deterrent to good law enforcement. And we're going to continue to see mass shootings and other egregious acts of violence committed by people who should otherwise have been prevented from owning a firearm.
Chris Marvin is a retired U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter pilot. He's now a principal at Marvin Strategies, a consulting firm that focuses on veterans-related issues and strategies. Chris, thank you so much.
Thanks, John.
This was the sound last night in Istanbul, Turkey, as protesters in support of President Erdogan rallied in historic Taksim Square. They're burning an effigy of Fethullah Gulen, the Turkish Muslim cleric in self-imposed exile in Pennsylvania, who Erdogan blames for organizing and triggering the attempted military coup. Today, citizens are wondering what happens next as Erdogan asserts his control in the form of arrests and continued purges of government officials. Asla Adintashbash is a journalist in Istanbul and a fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. She says people are filled with questions right now.
The government is blaming followers of a cleric who lives in the United States in Pennsylvania, but my sense is that it's a whole lot more extensive than that. And the reason it didn't work in the end was because at 4 or 5 p.m. on Friday afternoon, the Turkish intelligence got wind of it and therefore went to chief of staff and basically started mobilizing some units, and therefore the military was divided. But, you know, there's a lot we don't know in terms of who, what, when.
Would you say that people in Turkey view Fethullah Gulen, who is based in Pennsylvania, as you say, as a kind of Ayatollah Khomeini hanging over the head of President Erdogan? Or does he have a much lower profile than that? It's hard for Americans to understand how important Fethullah Gulen is. He's virtually unknown here in the U.S.
No, he's a little bit different than Khomeini, because here's a country that's kind of split in half between secularists and non-secularists. And I think that among the conservative base, Fethullah Gulen does have some following, but not the majority. And he's definitely been maligned by the government for the past three years for sure. So his followers are, I would say, a couple of million. Perhaps 3-4%, even less, of the population, but they're placed in very strategic positions. This is a man who's been investing in education, in secular education. He's getting his followers to open up schools across the world, and he's also been encouraging them to go into government service. But there's been a very serious fallout with the government. The government has blamed corruption investigations of 2014, which have touched upon Erdogan and his inner circle on the Gulen movement, and have subsequently put in jail many of the prosecutors, judges, and policemen that were involved in the string of corruption investigations. And they see this coup as a continuation of that.
One last issue. Essentially civil war in the east in Turkey that many people have been describing as an all-out insurgency around the Diyarbakir. Is this coup seen as something that will inflame that or settle that down? Would there be pressure to go back to a ceasefire, a truce, as was the case last year?
If the government is smart, they would definitely use this opportunity to actually go back to a ceasefire with the PKK and Kurdish militants that are fighting. But I think what happens in terms of the Kurdish insurgency and whether or not the government will go for a ceasefire will kind of depend on Erdogan's career plans. If he is willing to push for an executive presidency, sort of a U.S.-style presidential system, and go for a referendum around that, he may go with the Kurds, or he may go the other way and actually align himself with nationalists. He just does not have enough votes. I think he'll either pick the Kurds or the Turkish nationalists, and I think that's a very tragic situation for us. It's kind of an ironic situation that one of the main Kurdish human rights organizations that have traditionally looked after the human rights of Kurdish citizens has now come out warning the government that the coup plotters should not be mistreated. And these are a group of people that have been fighting the Kurds for the past 40 years. And now the Kurds are coming out and saying, but wait a minute, even if they may be guilty of a coup, torture and ill treatment is not acceptable according to human rights norms.
Asla Adintashbash is a journalist in Istanbul and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Asla, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Perhaps the most pressing issue for the United States regarding instability in Turkey is determining the status and safety of NATO's largest nuclear weapons arsenal, the Incirlik Air Base in southeastern Turkey, which has been active since the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and is currently conducting airstrikes in Syria, is just about 70 miles from the Syrian border. The bombs are part of an unintentional Cold War museum, though, left over from the 70s and 80s. There aren't even any aircraft capable of delivering those nuclear weapons stored at Incirlik. So why are they even in Turkey, and who's responsible for them? Eric Schlosser is the author of Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety.
We're talking about hydrogen bombs. The estimates are there are about 50 American hydrogen bombs stored at the Incirlik air base in Turkey. And the power was immediately cut off to that base. All flights in and out of the base were shut down. And it's a pretty unusual situation to occur at a facility with that many nuclear weapons, with any nuclear weapons, really.
Forgetting for the moment, or putting aside for the moment, the sense of what are the rules for Turkey regarding those nuclear weapons, what is NATO's set of rules regarding the security and storage of those nuclear weapons? Can any NATO nation, take them out, check them out, like in the library or something?
Well, they're not supposed to. We have American nuclear weapons in five countries in NATO, and technically they're American weapons, and they're only supposed to be taken out and used with our permission. The problem is that at these bases, the security of these weapons for these weapons is provided by the host country. Now, Belgium, for example, has been recently a hotbed of ISIS activity, and yet at an air base in Belgium, we have nuclear weapons. There was a major security breach at that air base in 2010 when some peace activists were able to sneak into the base, sneak into the buildings where the nuclear weapons were stored, and wander around. And when they were finally caught, they were caught by a Belgian soldier whose rifle seemed to be unloaded from the YouTube video that was posted online. So, you know, we really need to remember that these nuclear weapons are there and maybe have a national dialogue about why they're there and how well they're being protected.
Barring that dialogue, is there any monitoring of the weapons from the United States or from the Pentagon, or is it a matter of you have to call up the base and ask somebody if they know where all the nukes are?
Well, I'm sure it was a very tense situation in Turkey because, you know, the United States at that air base has the Air Force has planes, and we've been flying missions against ISIS. It's worth keeping in mind that the Incirlik base is only about 70 miles away from Syria and from a rebel-controlled area of Syria where ISIS is active. Now, we have planes at that base, and we have a munitions support group that's supposed to be looking after the weapons, but it's not a very large group of American forces there versus, you know, how many Turkish soldiers are on that base. As of yesterday, the power was still cut off at the base. They're a symbol of American support for Turkey, for NATO. The problem is they're not just symbols, they're actual weapons. And there's real concern that they could fall into the wrong hands.
One of these hydrogen bombs that you've described is a very unique weapon in that the tonnage, the kilotonnage, can be dialed up or down. And it could be deployed in a very customized basis. And I'm just wondering, you know, is this an ideal kind of a weapon for a terrorist?
Well, you know, any nuclear weapon would be an ideal weapon for a terrorist. These hydrogen bombs, they're called B-61 bombs, have a special dial-a-yield feature. So depending on the mission, you can have them, by rate of comparison, the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima had the explosive force of about 15,000 tons of TNT, so 15 kilotons. The bombs that are in Turkey range anywhere from 3/10 of a kiloton to 170 kilotons, so more than 10 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. And it's hard to see what their actual military mission would be. I mean, if you really want to strike a target in the year 2016 quickly, you use a missile. A missile is faster. A missile is more reliable because it can't be shot down. And a missile is more accurate.
Was there an explicit concern or response at any level at the Pentagon about the status of those weapons at this point?
The Pentagon won't acknowledge that those weapons are there. The concern that I heard about the status of these weapons was I wrote a book on nuclear weapons. I had sources for that book who were weapons designers. One of the sources helped design the underground vaults where these weapons are stored. Another is a former Air Force general who was assigned to NATO, and they raise real questions about why those weapons are there and how securely they're being guarded, especially at this Turkish airbase.
Finally, is it widely understood in southern Turkey and in Syria that those weapons are there?
Absolutely. It's widely understood in Turkey that they're there. And one of the real problems is that when the Cold War ended, in the American public in particular, there was the sense that this nuclear danger went away. But it never really did. And there are still thousands of these weapons out there. And we need to really think about where they're being kept, how they're being kept, and whether we still need them there.
Eric Schlosser is the author of Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. A film based on that book will be out in September. Eric, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And here's something to take with you today. Remember this?
Explorer, new data coming through.
What's the blowback, Houston?
It's not good. Most of our systems are gone. Debris chain reaction is out of control and rapidly expanding. Multiple satellites are down and they keep on falling.
Define multiple satellites.
Most of them are gone. Telecommunication systems are dead. Expect a communication blackout at any moment.
Kowalski visual of debris at 9 o'clock.
Half of North America just lost their Facebook.
Explorer, repeat. Expect a communication blackout at any moment.
Oh, it had to be... It had to be those scary scenes in the movie Gravity when space debris minced a space shuttle and its astronauts. Well, the European Space Agency has proposed the E-Deorbit, the Space Debris Hunter. It works with a variety of grabbers and hooks and even nets and lasers to drag and sweep garbage into a neat pile and then slow it down to get it into a lower orbit where it will fall into the atmosphere. That's right, the atmosphere, for the tens of thousands of pieces of individually tracked space debris. The atmosphere is our garbage disposal. If you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us at iTunes. Take us with you on your commute home from work. A great way to stay up on the news. Find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Watch out for that space debris. This is The Takeaway.